But today is VE Day. The war is
the
over.
The newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The worldwide web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.
Hello and welcome to The Wealth Show, where we discuss the key topics shaping the UK wealth management industry and investors' portfolios. My name is Jack McRae, and I'm joined today by Jonathan Unwin, Head of Portfolio Management at Mirabeau. This is why our top 100 star joined the firm in 2023, having previously spent time at Bank Haviland and Credit Suisse, and he's responsible for the management of discretionary client portfolios. Welcome, Jonathan.
Hello, thank you.
And obviously, there's no better place to start than in portfolio construction. So can you walk me and our listeners through your approach to fund selection?
To fund selection, yes. So our portfolios are typically multi-asset class portfolios, so across equities, fixed income, alternatives, and then cash. And we typically use active funds and ETFs where there's no compelling active fund available, in our opinion. So we have a relatively tight list of active funds that we select from. We have a specialist team based in Geneva who run a very focused list with approximately 2 to 3 funds in each major equity market and for the fixed income piece as well. And then the job is for us is if we make an asset allocation call for a certain region or a certain sector or theme, then I would choose a fund from that internal list, and that would go in the portfolios. In terms of our philosophy when it comes to fund selection, the key thing is consistency of approach and picking a manager who sticks to his knitting, who follows the objective of the fund through thick and thin, so we know exactly what we've got in portfolios at all time. Clearly, we look at past performance as an indicator, but we accept that in certain market environments, the funds will underperform, but providing they perform in line with their style, then by and large, we will stick with them and be happy.
And how much customization is involved in building client portfolios?
You mean per individual client? Mm-hmm. We certainly offer bespoke portfolios for our larger clients. We do try to push clients towards our key offerings because that's actually where the expertise and the resources of the bank are focused. But certainly if a client has in excess of £10 million to invest in a portfolio, then we can offer something tailored. But that should be really driven by the client. It shouldn't be us foisting something on them to try and sound clever. It's very much a case of a client needing something which is different to what he already holds, or if they have a specific interest or disinterest in a certain investment, then we would create something for them that works for them.
Yeah. And now looking at your asset allocation, you're currently quite heavily underweight fixed income.
Correct, yeah.
What's the thinking behind that, and where are you finding yield instead?
Yeah, I mean, the main reason, I suppose, is the fear of inflation, and that has seen yields, you know, as you know, this year, go higher and higher, particularly on the long end of the curve. So we've been very much underweight the longer end of treasuries, longer and long end of gilts, and other sovereign markets, and we've largely probably a good 50% underweight actually against our benchmark for fixed income, and where we are invested. It's very much in shorter dated government bonds. So we're picking up a bit of yield, you know, and not much less yield than even holding the longer dated bonds, but with much less duration risk. And also complementing that with some emerging market debt and high yield bonds as well, where mm-hmm. they're slightly more correlated with equities. And actually, it's by and large, despite the volatility, being a risk on market this year. So those have actually done quite well. So where we've been underweight, in fixed income, it hasn't cost us when the markets outperform, because where we have been positioned has been the right place.
Mm-hmm. We'll come on to emerging markets, but in Europe, we've seen divergence between economies.
Yeah.
How are you navigating that?
Yeah, Europe's an interesting market at the moment, but we're constantly looking for ways to diversify away from the main theme in markets at the moment, which of course is artificial intelligence and stocks associated with that. So Europe as a continent, as a place to invest, can potentially offer a good overall diversifier against that. If you're looking to increase equity exposure without taking on more AI risk, that's one way of looking. But you're quite right that actually, even at national level now and then different indices across the continent, markets are drawing apart. So it's not uncommon now for when I do my sort of weekly call to the bankers in our group that I report on performance, and stock 600 may be up, say, 2%. The DAX index, which is obviously Germany's market, where it's heavily exposed to global trade, to manufacturing, also to what's happening in China, as well as energy prices, that could be up 3 or 4%. But then the other end of the scale, you've got maybe have the FTSE, which is down a bit, as well as other economies like Spain and Italy, which are sort of trading in a different manner now to Germany. And then you have other indices, for example, Austria, which is very domestic focused as well. So if you're looking to buy a market which actually isn't too correlated to what's going on globally, then that's a way of looking at Europe. But there's definitely bifurcation now in which markets you buy rather than just buying, say, the stock 600.
Looking kind of more at alternatives now, gold's been trading remarkably, almost like a risk asset.
Yes.
And yet you're overweight. What's...
Yeah, I'd say it's been trading like a momentum asset rather than necessarily a risk asset. Certainly, we have a overweight position in gold and have done for several years. And we went double overweight at the beginning of 2025, which of course was a good call, as it had a stellar year last year. And it continued to do well at the beginning of this year. And then people expect it to behave like a safe haven asset. So a lot of people were taken by surprise when it tanked, when we had this invasion of Iran. And I think that it was slightly an idiosyncratic year for gold, actually. It was quite a unique reason why it sold off. And I think part of that is it's very liquid. And if you're an investor and you're sitting on you're sitting on a big gain in your gold position, and suddenly you want to raise liquidity, that's the obvious place to go would be somewhere like gold, because it you can trade it very quickly, it's very liquid. And essentially you're taking profits, and everyone likes taking profits rather than selling at a loss. So that's one reason why it sold off. And then, of course, it's also been dollar strength. When the dollar strengthens, gold tends to do the opposite. And then you also got the central banks, who have been structurally a big supporter of gold, perhaps holding back at that point, as well as you know, as I said, it wasn't trading like a momentum asset at the time, rather like a meme stock where people are piling in at the end because they see the chart going up and up. And then those same investors who are quite flighty suddenly reverse their position. But through that all, we've held on to our position. You know, historically, we've been trimming our profits and taking it back to our target position. But through the volatility this year, we've actually just left it. And obviously, we've had a couple of good weeks where gold's coming back into play again.
Would you say that's one of your best investment calls?
Certainly, the last 2 or 3 years, it's been a big driver of returns in our portfolios, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you moved underweight in emerging markets.
Yes.
But now you're neutral again. What's the thinking?
Yeah, it's been quite a story in emerging markets this year. We started 2026 relatively confident, actually, looking at the global outlook. And we thought we do need to diversify away from US growth and US technology. So we looked around the world, and actually we looked at emerging markets. And at the time, energy prices were fairly benign. You look at GDP growth, where is it strongest? And it is Asia, it's emerging markets. So the logical place for us to go overweight at that point, when we were feeling quite bullish, was emerging markets. Then you've suddenly got the outbreak of war in Iran, and it's not so much the war, it's the closure of Straits of Hormuz, the fact that energy prices then spiking. And of course, who are some of the most exposed markets or economies to higher energy prices? It's emerging markets. So we quickly had to reverse that position, because of the volatility and then the beta with the market, take it underweight. And then just to ride out the volatility, then as we had a peace deal announced and the direction of travel in the Middle East seems to be one of slightly calmer oil prices, although that could unravel quite quickly. But we added back to emerging markets, but not overweight as we were pre-Iran, but just back to a neutral weighting. So we like emerging markets, but we're not ready to go all in overweight again just yet.
Yeah, and the performance of emerging markets, would you say it's been driven by this handful of AI stocks?
Undoubtedly. Emerging markets 10, 15, 20 years ago was a different story to investing now. Historically, you would invest in emerging markets for the growing middle-class consumption story. So the classic example being people upgrading their toothbrush or their toothpaste or their soy sauce. And that doesn't really work anymore. So with emerging markets being so dominated, by, particularly by Asia and China. But you know, increasingly, if you look at the KOSPI index in Korea, it's two stocks, essentially over 50% of the index weight, and then of course Samsung in Korea, and they are all closely correlated to the global AI boom. So you're not, when you're just buying an emerging market exposure now, essentially you're taking a bet on that as well. And depending on how you're exposing the rest of your portfolio, you need to be very careful, because buying emerging markets isn't necessarily that traditional consumption or growing wealth story, or just simply a growing economy where you can just buy emerging market banks, etc. It's very much a correlated trade, so you need to be aware of what you're buying. And it's difficult to find an ETF or an active fund that isn't overweight in those handful of AI companies.
So how do you distinguish between short-term AI momentum and long-term structural winners?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a massive amount of rotation in the AI stocks this year. You think of recent years, it's all been Magnificent Seven. It's been Nvidia, Microsoft, Alphabet, and the semiconductors. And this year, we've had some real volatility. If you remember at the beginning of the year, we had the software stocks selling off because the fears were actually that a lot of these software companies were going to have their lunch eaten by artificial intelligence. That's sort of recovered a bit. If you look at Microsoft, it's returned. It's turned heavily into double figures returns this year, having been underwater for some time. And then companies like Nvidia as well, which were right in the center of AI, they sold off and then come back again. And people have then been selling semis. They've been then looking at hardware, and each of these different sub asset classes within AI have had their time in the sun this year. So we're trying to be very careful of how we position for the future. We don't just want to be all in on semis or all in on hardware or the hyperscalers. And I think the market is very much maturing now with respect to AI. It's now focused on which companies are actually monetizing the AI technology, not just the ones who are spending huge amounts of CapEx. So of course, the companies that have been spending a huge amount of CapEx that can't show profitability yet have been punished quite hard.
Mm.
Having said that, the earnings season so far has been incredibly robust for these companies, and they're returning increasingly huge profits. So actually, it's strange to have a situation where one of the most attractive parts of the US market in terms of valuation is now AI again, or technology, because the earnings are so strong that the ratio in terms of valuation is actually looking quite attractive, despite the price increase we've had this year.
And just on alternatives again, what is your offering in private markets?
Private markets, we do our own, we have our own in-house funds. We have an evergreen equity fund, and we have a more traditional private equity offering. We also offer club deals, so we get access to some of the most high-profile private equity names you've seen. A lot of our clients got in quite early on SpaceX, which is a big success story. We've also done various property deals as well in the UK and Switzerland. So it's something we do offer, and clients have a choice whether they pick individual company stories. And typically AI is very popular. Anything to do with Elon Musk is very popular. But we also have this more diversified approach as well for clients that don't want risk on one story.
Do private markets make up a big part of client portfolios?
We don't. We typically in the UK, we don't embed private assets within the portfolios. We put a lot of impetus on liquidity, and we like to know that we can sell down portfolios or increase very quickly without having to wait for the long-term settlements or uncertainty. So within the portfolios I run, we don't run them. As a bank, we do have an ultra high net worth offering where we can embed private assets within that. But most clients in the UK, maybe it's a cultural thing, prefer to have their private assets outside of their everyday discretionary portfolio.
Mm-hmm. You invest in funds rather than direct equities. When you're meeting a manager, how do you ensure they kind of perfectly capture your thematic views?
I mean, it's virtually impossible to get someone who perfectly replicates it. So it's more, as long as the fund is over sort of 50, 60% of what you're trying to do, then that would be acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Much like investing in a regional indice, you're not necessarily buying the underlying economy of that country, the FTSE 100 being a great example.
So likewise, when you're buying a thematic fund, you know that there'll be some impurities in there. And often it's actually very difficult to invest in certain themes anyway. One I can always think of is agriculture. Now, agriculture has been a thematic that banks and investment managers have been talking about for years. But actually investing in companies that are profitable at this stage in terms of, you know, future agricultural technologies to create more food more efficiently, they're notoriously difficult to generate profits now. So for our clients, it's not really viable because we need to be producing returns. Another example is we have had in the past thematic in climate change, so trying to invest in the climate transition, but again, finding underlying stocks that are actually profitable and may be making good returns in the here and now is very difficult. So we've had to sort of review that at certain times. So looking for a fund in those space, it can be difficult to find a pure play. So we would tend to go to individual stocks in a separate portfolio for that.
Yeah. When you meet a kind of prospective manager, is there an immediate non-negotiable red flag that sets off the warning signs kind of immediately?
Avoiding someone's personality, if you're trying to try and take out of the equation, I think the big thing for me is if I see something in the portfolio that just doesn't match what they're saying. There's been examples recently where cryptocurrency has found its way into certain equity funds. For me, that's a bit of a red flag. But mainly we're looking for consistency of approach. So if we can see equities in a portfolio that just don't fit the style, that's a red flag. Something particularly looking at regional equity funds as well. If I find a manager that has a sort of oversized allowance to go into a different region. So for example, a UK manager who had a 20 or 30% remit to go into Europe or the US, that would be a red flag to me, because all we're asking is you can pick 30, 40 stocks in the UK. Surely you can find that. You don't need to go and sort of bolster it by buying overseas. So I think that would be a distraction that I wouldn't like.
Mm. And is there currently a particular theme that is hardest to find a great active manager in?
A theme? I mean, we only have three or four themes. It's hard to find an active manager in many markets at the moment, to be quite honest. So in technology it is one. So we do have a disruptive technology theme. Finding a manager who outperforms the technology index is incredibly difficult, particularly if you're trying to avoid concentration risk like we are at the moment. So we actually, there is where we would choose an ETF. So we choose to hold a cyber security ETF and an automation and robotics ETF. And they've done incredibly well this year, actually. And they are slightly diversified. It's a different way of getting technology exposure. And that's because of the AI that's everywhere else. And we don't want a tech fund that just holds the same big names that anyone could buy. Mm-hmm. It's a way of getting exposure to the sector, but in a slightly nuanced way. And something like cybersecurity has the benefit of doing quite well. When defense stocks rally as well, there's a sort of overlap there. So that's quite an interesting way of getting more exposure in the portfolio without just copying the big companies that are held elsewhere already.
So where do you want active management right now?
I would love to find a US manager that could outperform consistently. Everyone wants an equity fund which performs in all market environments. That's virtually impossible, I think. But you have to make a choice. Either you choose the style, and you get this as a portfolio manager, you get the style right, and then you pick a manager who can outperform that style. Or you go for a sort of general fund, which maybe sort of tracks the bench, tracks the index, but outperforms by 1 or 2% year on year out. And so that's what we sort of try and do, a combination of both. Mm-hmm. The US market is notoriously difficult, so we do have a large passive position there. And then we have two or three slightly smaller active positions, which partially act as a hedge if the growth trade slows down and diversifies the portfolio. But where we would look to sell out is if there's a value rally and our value manager is nowhere near, it's not in the races, that's a concern.
Mm-hmm. Just on Mirabeau more generally, what are kind of you and the firm's ambitions kind of in the near to short-term future and looking?
Yeah, I mean, I think Mirabeau is a 200-plus-year-old bank. We are very much looking to grow, particularly in London, in the UK, and assets for our office are growing quite quickly, but we need to do it in a very sustained way. So one way a bank can get assets in is to offer sort of lending. You know, anyone can do that. That's not our focus. Our focus is very much on the investment offering. So we do that with a consistent, steady investment portfolios, a good offering there. So we're looking to grow, but we're looking to grow at a sensible rate. And the way we do that is by having good performance in our portfolios, and word of mouth gets out. Because most clients are banked with two or three different institutions now. So if they compare us against their other bank and we're doing well, then that's one way of growing. And it's, of course, it's having a steady reputation and hiring people who can attract quality clients. So we're very much in growth mode, but we're not looking to grow at the expense of the quality of the business.
Calculated growth.
Exactly.
Yeah. Just finally, what would you say your most contrarian position in your portfolios is?
To think about that. We have got too much cash at the moment. I would say not too much cash, but it's been a good call. We're slightly underweight equities, and I think that's probably contrarian. I think most people are loading up risk again now, and I think that's largely because we have this momentum sort of technique that we're trying to do. So there's that, but I think maybe we're underweight Japan, so we have no Japan at all in our portfolios. It's something we're reviewing because actually the Japanese market is quite interesting at the moment. It's a different, again, there's a big AI exposure. There's more the picks and shovels approach to AI stocks than buying the semiconductors. So that's something we're looking at, but that's been our sort of contrarian position for some time now, whether it's been the right call or not.
Why do you have no exposure to Japan?
I think historically, Japan's been a very difficult market for Europeans to invest in. So there's a sort of a dilemma there, one with the currency. Yeah, then the currency's been weakening for so long now that you have to take a view whether you hedge or not. There's still a bit of opaqueness when it comes to the Japanese market. You have to make a decision whether you invest domestically, and it's sometimes quite difficult to gauge what's going on domestically in terms of the economy there. Or you invest in Japan for the sort of the global nature with the big multinationals. So it's quite a complex market, and if you don't have a real expertise there, you know, there's other places you can go. So I think that's the idea, is that, well, actually, we understand the UK market, we understand the US, we understand Europe, that we'll take more at risk there and maybe leave Japan alone until it becomes crystal clear that it's a screaming, you know, opportunity. But I think most people would have Japan in their portfolios, and certainly as you know, our benchmark is very much global, Japan being the second biggest listing in terms of regional exposure, then that is quite contrarian.
Yeah. Well, that seems like a good point to end on. Thank you so much for joining us, Jonathan, and we will see you next time on The Wealth Show.
So strong. Thank you. But the rate terms of valuation is actually looking quite attractive, despite the price increase we've had this year. So private markets, we do our own, we have our own in-house funds.
But today is VE Day. The war is
the
over.
The crown queen waves from the Belt.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929. The Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Capital at risk.